Lecture 5. Call Me Ishmael. Introducing a character.
So far, in my first two lectures about character, I've been talking in general about how characters are different from real people and from each other. But in this lecture, I want to talk about what all characters have in common and to suggest a variety of techniques for introducing a character. In my next and final lecture about character, we'll talk about developing a character and about deploying different types of characters in the same narrative. Now, while there are no rules in creative writing, I want to lay out two general propositions that should help you in creating character. One is that fiction is all about the particular rather than the universal. Even if you have a large, overarching theme you're trying to get across, and even if you mean your characters to be representative of types of people, fiction is about individual people in a specific situation. That's one thing all characters have in common. They're constructed out of specific details. The other proposition, and the other thing that all fictional characters have in common, is that each character, no matter whether they're simple or complex, no matter whether they're round or flat, no matter whether they're the leading character or a minor character, each character has a purpose in the narrative. Each one almost always has something he or she wants or something at stake. We'll talk more about this in the next lecture as we talk about developing a character through the course of a narrative. But it's something you need to be thinking about when you're introducing a character. Whether you're imagining your characters from the inside out or from the outside in, whether you're imagining them based on their psychology or their circumstances, all characters are constructed out of specific, vivid, visceral, sensuous, evocative details. And both the writer and the reader are never more aware of those specific details than they are in the moment when they meet a character. In other words, meeting a fictional character is a lot like meeting someone in real life. Think about the first moment you met someone important to you, a spouse or a friend or even an enemy. And the chances are very good that what you remember most vividly is something very specific about them, a physical feature or something they were wearing or some gesture they made or something specific they said or the particular circumstances in which you met them. We have a very similar experience with fictional characters. First impressions are very important, and we know within a page or two if we find a character appealing, interesting, or annoying. Think about the stories or books where you've fallen in love with a character on first sight, or even the books where you've given up after the first few pages because you realized quickly that you didn't want to spend any more time with this person. In real life, it's considered rude to turn your back on someone you've just been introduced to. But with a story or a book, you can shut it and walk away, and no one's feelings are hurt. To help you think about making that all-important first impression, let's take a look at five different ways we can be introduced to a new character. One, through a straightforward description of the character. Two, by seeing the character in action. Three, through direct address in the first person from the character. Four, through report by other characters. Five, by placing the character in a specific time and place. As I go through the various examples of each technique, I especially want you to notice how each technique uses details and specifics, and how the introduction to the character reveals or at least hints at what the character wants. Perhaps the most straightforward way to introduce a character is simply to describe him or her. Here's the very first paragraph of one of my favorite novels, Joseph Conrad's Lord Jim. He was an inch, perhaps two, under 6 feet, powerfully built, and he advanced straight at you with a slight stoop of the shoulders, head forward, and a fixed from under stare which made you think of a charging bull. His voice was deep, loud, and his manner displayed a kind of dogged self-assertion which had nothing aggressive in it. It seemed a necessity, and it was directed apparently as much at himself as at anybody else. He was spotlessly neat, apparelled in immaculate white from shoes to hat, and in the various eastern ports where he got his living as a ship chandler's water clerk, he was very popular. Now here's your main character coming right off the page at the reader, and we see him vividly and whole from his fixed from under stare to his immaculate white shoes. The introduction is compelling and intriguing, which is what the opening of a novel should be. Here's a rather attractive character who also has a bit of mystery about him. Think about that dogged self-assertion that is directed apparently as much at himself as anybody else. Without giving anything away, that's the main character of Lord Jim in a nutshell. He's a man who has something to prove to himself, and the rest of the book shows why that's the case and how he goes about it. The introduction is also economical. It's not the sort of description that lingers over every detail of a character's appearance and his clothing, but merely suggests physical attributes that evoke awkwardness, the slight stoop of the shoulders, the deep, loud voice, and adds a few conjectures about his character, that his manner was assertive but not aggressive, and allows the reader to fill in the rest. This is not to say that giving an elaborate description of the character is necessarily a bad thing. Lots of books and stories introduce the physical appearance of a character in great detail. As always, it depends on the book and on what you're trying to do. At any rate, the point is that Jim is shown to us, not told. He is evoked. We know that he is muscular, that he is fastidious about his appearance, that he has a direct, blunt, but not intimidating manner, and that he is concerned with proving something to himself. After little more than 100 words, we have a very intriguing, though not comprehensive, view of the main character. I also want you to notice that although this description is very detailed and specific, it's not tied to a specific moment in Jim's life. We're not getting a scene, per se. And I also want you to notice that this is an example of a character being introduced to us from the outside in. We're seeing how he appears to other people, not how he seems to himself. And just to reiterate what I said in the last lecture, defining a character from the outside in is not the same as defining him by his circumstances, just as defining a character from the inside out is not the same as defining him by his psychology. Although we hear Jim speaking later in the book, we're never really inside his head, and yet Lord Jim is fundamentally a psychological portrait of an idealistic young man trying to live down a moment of cowardice. Now let's take a look at a character who is introduced to the reader in a specific moment through a specific action. It comes from another favorite novel of mine, a very slim book called Light by the English writer Eva Figgis. Here's the opening of the book. The sky was still dark when he opened his eyes and saw it through the uncurtained window. He was upright within seconds, out of the bed, and had opened the window to study the signs. It looked good to him, the dark just beginning to fade slightly, midnight blue-black, growing gray and misty, through which he could make out the last light of a dying star. It looked good to him, a calm pre-dawn hush without a breath of wind and not a shadow of cloud in the high, clear sky. He took a deep breath of air, heavy with night scents and dew on earth and foliage. His appetite for the day thoroughly aroused, his elated mood turned to energy, and he was into his dressing room, into the cold bath, which set his skin tingling, humming an unknown tune under his breath. This is also a very intriguing opening, though in a different way. It's dynamic in a way that the opening of Lord Jim is not. The character is in action, with all his senses awake, right from the first sentence. And he looks at the view outside his window with a gaze that is both practiced and eager. Moments later, he's in a cold bath, his senses tingling. And unlike the opening of Lord Jim, where we can only surmise what Jim is thinking from his appearance, Figgis gives us direct access to the character's thoughts. Although we don't know it yet, this is the French artist Claude Monet, and he's just decided that this will be a very good day to paint. But even before we realize who the man is, we get a vivid and attractive first impression of a man who pays keen attention to the natural world and is eager to engage with it, though we don't know why or how till a few pages further on. And yet, unlike the opening of Lord Jim, it tells us nothing of his physical appearance and not much more about his psychology than the simple fact that he's enthusiastic about starting his day. But whereas in Lord Jim it's the hint of complexity in the character that keeps us reading, in this case it's the character's energy and our curiosity to discover why he's so engaged with the natural world. So even though we don't learn as much about Monet in this opening paragraph as we do about Jim in his opening paragraph, the opening of Light is just as compelling. There's another tried and true way of introducing a character, one that seems somehow uniquely American, though I'm sure there are plenty of similar examples in the literature of other countries. This is by having the main character, or at least the first-person narrator, directly address the reader. Three of the novels that are often cited as the great American novel open this way. Moby Dick begins with its narrator inviting the reader to call me Ishmael. The Great Gatsby opens with Nick Carraway, who isn't the main character, but who is the predominant voice in the book, speaking directly to the reader. And, of course, there's the opening of Mark Twain's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. You don't know about me without you have read a book by the name of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, but that ain't no matter. Over the years, there have been any number of great American novels whose narrators address the reader on the opening page. Saul Bellow's The Adventures of Augie March, the title of which deliberately echoes Twain, opens with a declamatory sentence that evokes Melville. I am an American, Chicago-born, Chicago, that somber city, and go at things as I have taught myself, freestyle, and will make the record in my own way. First to knock, first admitted, sometimes an innocent knock, sometimes not so innocent. The narrator of Marilyn Robinson's novel Housekeeping also echoes Melville by announcing in the first sentence, "My name is Ruth," and then echoes Twain by immediately summarizing the story so far, the way Huck Finn does in the first few paragraphs of his novel. Here's a more recent example by the novelist Kate Christensen from her book The Epicure's Lament. October 9, 2001. All the lonely people indeed. Whoever they are, I've never been one of them. The lack of other people is a balm. It's the absence of strain and stress. I understand monks and hermits, anyone who takes a vow of silence or lives in a far-flung cave. And I thought, I hoped rather, that I would live this way for the rest of my life, whatever time is left to me. In the subsequent paragraphs, this narrator, Hugo Whittier, gives us some specific details of his morning, as well as some hints of his backstory. But mainly what this opening gives us, and what it has in common with all those other first-person openings I just listed, is that it draws the reader in with a very specific and intriguing voice. In this example, we can see right away that the character is literate and erudite, that he not only prefers his own company, but that he harbors an active hostility to other people, and that he's something of a fatalist who doesn't expect to live much longer. In all these examples, the paragraphs immediately following the opening line or paragraph start to fill in the details about the character's history and current situation. But what draws us in is the fact that we're hearing an individual person telling us his or her story in a way that only he or she could tell it to us. So even if we don't know what they look like right off the bat or see them in action right away, and most of the books I've just mentioned, we don't get action for a few pages yet, we know we're hearing from a unique and specific individual. Another way to introduce the character is by report. Now, obviously, if you want to be nitpicking about it, all fictional characters are introduced to us by report through the intermediary of the writer. But, as I say, in fiction, we often have the illusion of direct access. But some characters are presented to us only through the eyes of other characters. Jim in Lord Jim is one such character, since we never get inside his head and mainly learn his story through other characters. Another example is Jay Gatsby, whose story is told to us by the first-person narrator, Nick Carraway. The example I want to quote from, though, is William Faulkner's famous story, A Rose for Emily. Here's the first paragraph. When Miss Emily Grierson died, our whole town went to her funeral. The men through a sort of respectful affection for a fallen monument, the women mostly out of curiosity to see the inside of her house, which no one save an old manservant, a combined gardener and cook, had seen in at least 10 years. Right away, you notice that it's an unnamed first-person narrator speaking on behalf of his or her entire town. Then, after four paragraphs that describe Miss Emily's house, her family history, and her standoffish relationship with the town, we get a very detailed physical description as part of a brief flashback describing the day that the town's alderman paid a visit to her, hoping to persuade her to pay her taxes. They rose when she entered, a small, fat woman in black with a thin gold chain descending to her waist and vanishing into her belt, leaning on an ebony cane with a tarnished gold head. Her skeleton was small and spare. Perhaps that was why what would have been merely plumpness in another was obesity in her. She looked bloated, like a body long submerged in motionless water and of that pallid hue. Her eyes, lost in the fatty ridges of her face, looked like two small pieces of coal pressed into a lump of dough as they moved from one face to another while the visitors stated their errand. This is perhaps the most vivid of the introductions I've cited so far, And mainly what I want you to notice about it is that we're not seeing Miss Emily from a remote third-person point of view, as in the opening of Lord Jim or the opening of Light. And we're not hearing from her directly in her own voice, as in the Epicure's Lament. But rather, we're hearing about her from the communal point of view of an entire community. And that's important, especially in this story. A character is being revealed to us as an object of fascination to an entire town. And because Emily has withdrawn herself from the life of the community, the people of the town have spun all sorts of legends and theories around her, all of which have the rug yanked out from under them at the end of the story, which is one of the creepiest endings in American literature. As always, I want you to notice the very vivid, even pungent details Faulkner deploys to describe Miss Emily, especially that wonderfully disturbing comparison of her elderly, fat body to that of a bloated corpse submerged in water. And not just any water, but motionless water. Again, without giving the ending away, this single paragraph foreshadows a great deal about the character and her story, without being explicit, and at the same time, it provides the reader with an extremely vivid, one might almost say repulsive, visual impression of her. The four ways I've suggested so far of introducing a character certainly aren't exhaustive, and I also want to make it clear that very, very rarely does any introduction of a character rely solely on one technique. The last example, From a Rose for Emily, combines several techniques at once: introduction by report, introduction by physical description, and in the paragraphs immediately following the paragraph I quoted, introduction by showing the character in action, speaking dismissively to the men who've come to see her. Let's take a look at one more way of introducing character, namely the technique of introducing a character by situating him or her in a very specific time or place. This is the opening paragraph of Robert Stone's A Flag for Sunrise. Father Egan left off writing, rose from his chair, and made his way, a little unsteadily, to the bottle of Flor de Canna, which he had placed across the room from his desk. The study in which he worked was lit by a Coleman lamp. He had turned the mission generators off to save kerosene. The shutters were open to receive the sea breeze, and the room was cool and pleasant. At Freddy's Chicken Shack up the road, a wedding party was in progress, and the revelers were singing along with the radio from Puerto Alvarado, marking the reggae beat with their own steel drums and crockery. Again, as in A Rose for Emily, this is a very pungent introduction to a character, but one which relies almost entirely on his circumstances and a little bit of action, rather than a description or direct access to his thoughts. We get no physical description of Father Egan, but we know from the very first sentence that he's a bit of a scholar because he's been writing, and we also know that he's been drinking because he's unsteady on his feet, and that he's self-conscious about his drinking because he has deliberately placed the bottle across the room from his desk so that he has to get up each time he wants another drink. The rest of the paragraph says nothing about him specifically, but with great economy and expertly deployed detail shows us that he's living at a mission in a third world country where money is scarce, that it's near the sea, and that the local residents are probably impoverished, celebrating a wedding noisily at a place called Freddy's Chicken Shack. The rest of the chapter tells us a great deal more about Father Egan's situation and history, and about the perilous political situation in a fictional Latin American country during the 1970s. But that opening paragraph gives us a very vivid and compelling portrait of a lonely, drunken priest, cut off from any intellectual stimulation, far from home, simultaneously using the setting to show us the character and the character's point of view to show us the setting. Let's pause for a moment here and sum up the lessons of the previous examples, specifically what they all have in common. Each one is constructed of specific, evocative details of Jim's physical appearance in Lord Jim, of Claude Monet's energetic actions in Light, of Hugo's comic bitterness in the Epicure's Lament, of Emily's appearance and imperious manner in A Rose for Emily, and of Father Egan's physical setting in A Flag for Sunrise. More importantly, each introduction tells us at least one thing about the character that turns out to be important later on, and at least hints at what the character has at stake. Right from the start, we know that Jim has something to prove to himself, that Claude Monet is passionately engaged with the natural world, that Hugo loathes the company of other people, that Emily has withdrawn from the world for some reason, and that Father Egan has isolated himself in a remote village in a distant country. So given that what each of these characters wants or has at stake is at least hinted at from our very first meeting with them, how much does the writer have to know about the character before he or she even starts writing? Well, for one thing, as I mentioned in my first lecture, you don't need to write a story or a novel in the same order as the reader is going to read it. You can craft the meatier parts of the character's story first, and then go back and write the opening in such a way as to foreshadow what you've already written. Another method is to work out all of the character's physical details, history, and context in advance. You might call this the iceberg theory of character creation. On the principle that most of an iceberg is out of sight below the waterline, keeping the visible part afloat, some writers concoct whole backstories for their characters, even if they don't use all or even most of it in the finished story. Some writers even create a dossier or a journal for each major character in a story, crafting a detailed history of each character and compiling every quirk and idiosyncrasy before they ever put them in a story. The novelist and teacher Janet Burroway compares this technique to the famous method used by actors, one of the features of which is that actors are required to write biographies of their characters, coming up with details that even the playwriter or screenwriter hadn't thought of. This method has a lot to recommend it, since it means even before you start to worry about plot, you have a fully formed character fixed firmly in your head, making it easier to decide what he or she is likely to do at any given moment as the plot develops. As I said in the opening lecture of this course, there is no right or wrong way to do things in fiction writing, so if this works for you, have at it. That said, my own experience of creating characters is a more indirect, exploratory, and improvisatory process, and I suspect that's the case with many other writers. Writers who work this way start with only a little bit of information about a character, the way a person looks, perhaps, or even a simple character trait like a nervous tic, or even just the way they wear a hat. We don't start with a full portrait of a character, but with a glimpse just intriguing enough to make us want to follow that character through scene after scene, to see how the character develops, or simply to see what he does next. The iceberg method is perhaps like that of a classical composer, who composes detailed sketches of themes and movements before embarking on the entire symphony. While my method is perhaps more like jazz, where a musician takes a scrap of melody and sees what he can spin out of it for 20 minutes at a stretch. Please bear in mind that I'm not necessarily endorsing my way of doing things, which is kind of a weird thing to say, actually, but let me explain how it has worked for me in the past and why I still create characters that way, on the fly, as it were. When I was writing my first novel, The Wild Colonial Boy, one of my main characters was a terrorist, a member of the Irish Republican Army named Jimmy Coogan. All I knew about him to begin with was that he was disgruntled with the leadership of the IRA, and he wanted to embarrass them by setting off an unauthorized bomb in central London. But that's all I had. A Northern Irish Catholic in his late 20s or early 30s, who hated the British, but who hated certain members of his own organization even more. I didn't know what he looked like, I didn't know what he sounded like, I didn't know how he thought. I could have invented a complicated backstory for him or filled a notebook with a dossier detailing everything I could think of about him, but instead, I simply started writing the novel, putting him in a car with 10 pounds of plastic explosive on his way to a meeting with a Confederate. It was only as I wrote that I started accumulating details. He wasn't just driving a car, he was driving a rented Ford Escort that smelled of cigarette smoke. And he wasn't just carrying the explosives, he was carrying them in a leather Adidas sports bag. And he wasn't just going anywhere for the meeting but to Giant's Causeway, a tourist destination on the northern coast of Ulster, away from the prying eyes of British soldiers and policemen. As I accumulated these details, I began to sense not only his wariness, but also his self-consciousness about being wary, which made him uncomfortable. I also took care of some exposition by having him mull over why he was breaking ranks with the leadership of the IRA. But even then, he didn't really come alive to me until I gave him a particular item of clothing, namely a brand new raincoat, the kind with big lapels and a belted waist. It was the sort of coat, in fact, that an IRA man of the late 1970s or early 1980s would never have been caught dead in. Real Irish terrorists of the era were a pretty scruffy lot, working class guys from very rough neighborhoods in Belfast. So when I had my scruffy working class character steal an expensive Burberry raincoat from a posh men's store in London, he suddenly snapped into focus and became an individual, a living person. The theft not only symbolized his break with the puritanism and caution of the IRA leadership, who certainly didn't want their operatives drawing attention to themselves with flashy trench coats, but more importantly, it symbolized Jimmy's own self-mythologizing romanticism and vanity. Here was a character who not only had decided to break with the discipline and orthodoxy of a radical movement, he wanted to look good while he was doing it. So by giving him this incongruous coat, I began to learn what Jimmy Coogan looked like, what he sounded like, how he carried himself when he walked down the street. It's entirely possible I would have arrived at the same point if I had used the iceberg method and painstakingly constructed a dossier for Jimmy in advance. It's possible I might even have come up with the raincoat, but I kind of doubt it. I had to launch myself, sink or swim, into the story by putting a guy I barely knew into a complicated situation and, by the steady accumulation of detail, the Ford Escort, the Adidas bag, Giant's Causeway, stumbling onto the one detail that gave me the key to his character, that showed me that not only was he a true believer who refused to compromise his revolutionary ideology, but also that he was vain, cocky, and rash. By writing my way into Jimmy Coogan, I was also telling myself the story, learning about Jimmy bit by bit, the same way the reader eventually would. But here is where the iceberg method and mine come together. By the time I finished the book, I knew Jimmy Coogan intimately, and you could have asked me anything about him. What did he like to drink? What was his favorite movie? What was his mother like? And I could have told you, perhaps not instantly, but after a moment or two of reflection. If you'd asked me what he was like before I started writing, I couldn't have told you much about him at all. It was only by the actual process of writing him that he became clear to me, so that even though I could hardly answer any questions about him when I started, by the time I finished the book, I could have told you things about him I'd never consciously considered. Even if I didn't use the iceberg method, I ended up with an iceberg. In other words, creating character is usually and most productively a process of exploration. By discovering a character as you go, you are learning about the character the same way that the reader will, a bit at a time. And when you think about it, the iceberg method works pretty much on the same principle. It's just that you do all the hard graft of imagining the character independently of creating the plot. You're still working by trial and error, trying out bits in your character journal and rejecting them, making the character clearer and clearer with each step. I'm just saying that for me, the process works better if I'm telling the story at the same time, because the story reveals the character, even as the character determines the story. I'm not saying my way is easier or even more efficient. In fact, it's probably less efficient. You will wander into blind alleys and dead ends, and you may find yourself tearing up whole chapters and starting them over, the way I have many times. But you might also say that those blind alleys and dead ends are signs that the process is working. If you write a scene that feels flat or seems like something the character wouldn't do, that means that the character has started to live an independent existence in your imagination, digging in his heels or standing up on her hind legs and saying, "I won't do that. That's not me." And that's a very good sign, because then your character is beginning to behave like a real person with a will and an inner life of his own, and he or she will come alive on the page. So whichever method you prefer, creating the character independently of the story or making him up as you go along, the point is that while you don't have to know a character completely when you start, if things go the way they're supposed to, you'll know him by the end as well as you know yourself, and maybe even better. In the meantime, here's an exercise to help you think about introducing a character. Take someone you know a lot about, either in your personal life or someone famous, and write a paragraph about them as if you were introducing them for the first time as a fictional character. Bear in mind as you write it that your imaginary reader is meeting these people for the first time, so you're going to have to think hard about what sort of first impression they make, how they look, how they act, how they speak. If you're writing about someone famous, write it as if that person isn't famous and we're meeting her for the first time. If you're writing about someone you know personally, write it as if they're never going to read it, and then for heaven's sake, don't show it to them. This is meant to be a writing exercise, one that focuses your attention on distilling a whole person into a few hundred words. In the next lecture, we'll be talking about how to use different types of characters, round and flat characters, major and minor characters, in the same narrative. And we'll be looking at examples from the work of Twain, Dickens, Fitzgerald, and the Scottish mystery writer, Denise Mina.